Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is my good friend, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm, Capital Alpha Partners, who joins us each week or almost every week to give us his view on the week ahead and whatever else is on his mind. Byron, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Vago.
Absolute pleasure and hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving. I understand it was a little bit smaller, as I think everybody's was, than their customary get-together.
Yes, I think we're going to have leftover turkey for the balance of December.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Great note, as always, Byron, on what to expect in the week ahead, as well as your thoughts on some big issues. Talk to us a little bit about where we are on President-elect Joe Biden's selection of a defense secretary. We had an expectation that would be in the first tranche of national security leaders that were announced last week. The folks were expecting the announcement maybe to come out this week, but it looks like Janet Yellen is being named Treasury Secretary. And so this announcement tomorrow, when it formally happens, will include the President-elect's economic team. What should we draw from this, right? I mean, many people saw Michelle Flournoy, the former Undersecretary of Policy, who went ahead with Tony Blinken to create West Exec Advisors, a strategic consultancy, has seen some unexpected opposition. Now we're hearing a whole bunch of other folks who are being considered for the SecDef job. Obviously, former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson, who was an exceptionally talented leader, leading the Department of Homeland Security, but also with distinction as the General Counsel in the Pentagon. Folks talking, of course, about Tammy Duckworth, the senator from Illinois who was mentioned before, and now even General Lloyd Austin, the Army, former Army vice chief, although there are some who make the case that a retired general officer shouldn't take that job. A good conservative Republican friend of mine had opposed Mattis for the same reason. He's not crazy about having a retired military person of such rank leading the Pentagon. What should we draw from this rather public and somewhat more prolonged debate that we've been seeing?
Well, you know, we kind of go through this every 4 years, or every year there's a transition in an administration, Vago. And I think, you know, the first observation is don't always believe what the rumor mill is coughing up here. You know, Tony Blinken ends up being Biden's pick for Secretary of State. And, you know, the consensus, I think, was, oh, that could go to Susan Rice. And as much as Michelle Flournoy's name has been front and center for SecDef, you know, it is a bit surprising that announced last week. And to your point, you know, there's been a flurry of media speculation, really about progress back or pushback by progressives on a Flournoy, Michelle Flournoy's being Secretary of Defense. So I think names that have come up, but, you know, they're interesting. Jay Johnson is another name that's come up. You know, if the fundamental issue here is that these people had ties in one way or another to the defense sector, Michelle Flournoy, because of her work at Center for New American Security, then, you know, her board work at Booz Allen and the consultancy that she had that I'm sure advised some of the defense contractors. You know, if you look at the rest of that stable, Jay Johnson serves on the board of Lockheed Martin. Right. General Austin serves on the board of Raytheon Technologies. So if that's your litmus test, you're going to winnow your field down pretty quickly. I suppose that leaves Senator Duckworth. But, you know, is she really the one who will kind of be able to deal with Congress in what's going to be a pretty contentious period, I think, of trying to make change in the Department of Defense with a flat set of budget numbers?
You know, there was this sense that Joe Biden is going to approach this with, you know, open hands and open hearts, as it were, to try to pick moderates. There is very much a sense that that's what he's done so far, right? I mean, Janet Yellen is not a controversial choice. Tony Blinken is very much a day one talent to lead the State Department, for example. Avril Haines, very, very talented, right? Alex Mayorkas. I mean, all these guys are very much in a moderate mold for that he's picking. Do you think, how tense do you think the situation is going to be, especially after that extraordinary tweet by Marco Rubio saying, like, you know, these are decent people who will manage the decline, an interesting position to take, as Fred Hyatt observed in his piece, that somebody who's believed in all the things that these people believe in has been less strong about those convictions because he's been, very quietly backing what Donald Trump has been doing.
Yeah, well, I guess a couple of points. First, Biden intends to nominate Neera Tanden as director of OMB, and I think that's already kind of becoming a lightning rod. I saw Senator Cronin of Texas came out against that nomination or pending nomination. So I would agree. I think, in general, this first tranche of national security people will probably make it through Senate confirmation hearings. That's a presumption on my part without a lot of drama. And I suppose, you could stand and fight a SecDef nomination, but, you'd really have to find someone pretty far left, I think, to block that nomination. I can't think of anyone in recent years who really failed. Maybe was it Tower who was nominated, and that was ultimately pulled, but I think that was due to some improprieties, and Cheney was then nominated and went through Senate approval in fairly short order. So I still think, you have to ask, what is Biden going to be looking for in a Secretary of Defense? And I think clearly he's put together a national security team so far that is going to embrace this idea about we're strong with our alliances. And so that part of the equation is there. My personal view is you've got to have someone who can really effectively engage and deal with Congress, which still will probably be divided party control. And even in the House, Democratic majority, but with a fairly slim majority, it's going to be tough to get some of these things done that Biden administration will want to do with the Department of Defense. So that ability to engage, negotiate, work with Congress on making change in, as I said, I think you're going to see some very tough trade-offs with flat defense budgets and a still robust set of challenges that the Department of Defense and more broadly the United States is going to be facing in the global security realm.
Are you convinced that there will be an adult conversation about this in a bipartisan way, or does this become a nihilistic effort, right? Republicans have rediscovered the debt. We've been talking about this on the Washington Roundtable podcast that you join us for as well, that, the more it looked like a Democrat was going to win the White House, the more Republicans started talking about the importance of controlling the debt, which is very rarely a Republican priority when they are in office. Does this, do you think, set the stage for something that, right? I mean, the whole effort here is to curtail Joe Biden's domestic agenda and social agenda, and in the process try to be able to paint the Democrat as weak. We increased defense spending. He cut defense spending in part because he may be presented with some rather binary choices here at the end of the day. I mean, do you think that is it too late to say this is over even before it starts? Is that too negative?
I think it really is the to be determined part of this, right? I mean, you're already, in effect, you're going to be, your setup is you're running for the midterm election, and then you've got a group of people in the Senate who also are going to be running for the 2024 election, regardless of what Donald Trump says he's going to do. So I think, I don't want to say, abandon all hope, ye who enter here. I think the key is going to be, can national security leadership be adept enough at showing this is what's got to get done. You can't solve these issues by just throwing more money at it. And I think, you know, if you look at national opinion polls, national security is still relatively low on the order of the public's priorities. The economy, healthcare are much higher ranked. And so I still think that if the arguments, if you really do see that nihilistic approach that nothing's going to get done in Congress, then that's a discussion that ought to be taken to a broader national audience, and then we'll see how the elections play out.
You think the State Department is going to be a winner. Walk us through your logic and what does winning mean, right? Budgetarily, strategically. I mean, I think the president-elect was sending a very clear message that leading his national security team was the Secretary of State, right?
Yeah, and there's not good data on this, Vago, but there had been a decline in Foreign Service officers, people taking the Foreign Service exam. there's been a broader discussion about, shouldn't we be emphasizing some of these softer elements of power, particularly in a competition with China? That if you just have, the one knife you have in the drawer is your military, that can be a pretty brittle approach to providing security in a broader context. And it's just interesting. I mean, I looked at State Department, or really not State Department, it's the 150 budget function, to get a little in the weeds on this, for international affairs. So it includes State Department, it includes AID, it includes national security assistance. And for the last couple of years, the Trump administration had come in each year with a budget that slashed that number. Congress never saw fit to go with it. I do think, there have been two reports, Council of Foreign Relations and Harvard, both released reports recently about kind of rebuilding the U.S. diplomatic corps, or foreign service, or whatever you want to call it. They didn't assign numbers with that, but I think at the margin, you could probably see a bit more money go to State Department for really kind of core foreign operations or engagement. That if that's a swing of a billion or so from the Department of Defense budget, it's not going to kill the DOD. It could probably do a lot more for international security, international affairs, just given the relative size of the two different budgets. You're talking about about $741 billion for national defense, and something in the $54 billion range in discretionary spending for international affairs.
One of the points you also made is Turkey and India as sort of increasingly prominent system suppliers, right? In our mindset, we see the United States, we see Western powers, we see Russia, we see China and Israel. We tend not to put into those sort of top league Turkey or India. Talk to us about the developments that triggered your noting that these could have potentially market-changing implications at the end of the day.
I think it's just interesting. It's an evolution, right? It's not a dramatic development, but there had been a lot of commentary recently about the effectiveness of Turkish drones, specifically the Bayraktar TB2, in both Libya and then in the conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And I think what was interesting, if you step back and looked at that, kind of how did that capability arise from Turkey? It was partly a reflection of U.S. export policy and then a change in relations that Turkey had with Israel. So, they start to develop their own drone capability. Interestingly, the company, Bayraktar, was founded by a guy who went to University of Pennsylvania for an MA and then was pursuing a PhD at MIT. And those drones were equipped with kit supplied by WESCAM, which is an L3 Harris operation out of Canada, and then an Edo subsidiary, also Harris, L3 Harris out of the UK. Now, Canada announced they were cutting off the WESCAM product export, and so Turkey turned around and developed its own gimbal turret sensor lasing device. So you see these kind of cross currents, which is, you know, as much as the U.S. tries to control the technology, it can't always control the people. And I think that's just an important consideration when you think about controls in general, that it's not just about the export of product, but you really have to think about where are people educated, what skills they take, and how to, and this isn't new. This has been going on as long as there's been an arms industry. And I thought on India and this, you know, it's not a new development. It's been going back and forth, but I think there was a press report probably a week and a half ago or so in the Indian papers that when there'll be a state level visit between the head of India and the Philippines, there'll be a deal signed for the BrahMos cruise missile. It'll be a land-based variant, but it's the first time I can remember India really exporting a pretty sophisticated weapon to a country that also, you know, has of keen interest to China, particularly when you think about some of the potential conflict zone in the eastern part of the South China Sea. So I, you know, these are subtle trends, but I think when people start thinking about what can play out over the 2020s and how the defense sector could change, you know, it's not just about what goes on in U.S. and European industry. It's some of these emerging defense industries that people have to keep an eye on as well.
And of course, the BrahMos missile being a collaborative venture between India and Russia for a 6,000-pound hypersonic weapon with a 440-pound warhead. So it's a pretty significant and significantly capable weapon with a range of about 650 kilometers. Let's go to the week in Washington. What are some of the things that are on your radar screen and you think people should be paying attention to?
Well, three I'd keep an eye on. General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is going to speak at Brookings this Wednesday. Be interested to see if he says anything about the FY22 budget, national defense strategy, you know, what iterations, what can be done here. He'll obviously be sticking around, but I don't think he's made a public appearance at one of the think tanks for some time. And then the other one will be Ellen Lord, who's the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Sustainment, will be speaking in Hudson on Thursday. That'll be kind of her, you know, end of term presentation. It's just kind of interesting, you know, usually people, when they make these kind of appearances, it's kind of, well, what have I accomplished? But I'm also curious what she says. What didn't she get done? What still needs to get done? What else is in that portfolio right that really needs some TLC?
A couple of other things, right? The Senate Armed Services Committee is holding a Navy Marine Corps readiness hearing, and then the West Coast Aerospace Forum, right? A couple of other events.
The readiness hearing is fascinating. There have been, you and Chris are probably closer to this than I am, but there's just been some interesting analysis recently about, you know, how hard we've been running our carrier fleet. And then some imagery that I think Commander Salamander posted on one of the DDG-51s, and just, you know, she'd been on a deployment and looked like a rust bucket. And so, you know, we're still running these assets very hard. Naval vessels, and I assume you could say the same about other airborne, even our land vehicle inventory. So that is worth a gander. And then this RAND forum that happened, I think this is the sixth year they're doing it. It's usually the day before the Reagan Defense Forum occurs in Simi Valley. This year, of course, that's not happening. So they're going to do this virtually, RAND will. And it's, in the past, it's had some very interesting insights into what the Air Force is up to in terms of some of their priorities, even how they're changing operations to deal with great power competition. So that's a 3-day event that's virtual, and a lot of these virtual events, they break them down into kind of bite-sized increments. So there are going to be other broker conferences going on. A number of companies will be presenting at those. But I don't know. I frankly spend a little bit more time in the RAND event if I have my choice, which I do.
Exactly. And I should also say among the partners in that are the Air Force Association's Mitchell Institute, as well as the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And I think Aerospace Corporation is also among the sponsors of that terrific event. Last couple of points, Atlantic Council and CSBA also has events.
Atlantic Council has an event that looks at really kind of defense innovation in the Indo-Pacific theater. General Cartwright's going to be speaking at that. There's also a report. So I find that that will be of interest. And CSBA has another kind of review of one of the reports I did on really selective disclosure of what our capabilities are and how we potentially could keep adversaries off balance.
And last thing, IISS, the International Institute for Strategic Studies, obviously does the Shangri-La Dialogue, which is the Pacific's leading forum in Singapore every year in June. And then you have the Manama Dialogue in Bahrain. What are your expectations out of the Bahrain conference this year?
Well, you know, the hot button issue this week is going to be Iran and how Iran might respond to the assassination of one of its nuclear scientists. So I don't expect anything sharply different out of this. I still think Iran will probably play it close to the chest. But that's, and then, you know, the broader kaleidoscope of changing relations, you know, already Israel and some of the new diplomatic relations, UAE in particular. But I think Iran will be the focal point of that event.
Byron, thanks as always for joining us. Really appreciate it as always. Look forward to having you on again soon.
Okay. Thanks, Bago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.